Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. In the news this week, President Trump says he wants out of Syria.
I want to get back. I want to rebuild our nation. Think of it, $7 trillion over a 17-year period. We have nothing. Nothing except death and destruction.
He also wants to send troops to the border with Mexico. Here's Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen.
Our current border security and immigration laws fail the American people. The system rewards bad behavior. It does not punish lawbreakers. It undermines our nation's economic interests.
And Oklahoma teachers with a lesson on perseverance, striking for a fifth day over low pay and school funding. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Karen Tumulty, Olivier Knox, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. Do you see a trade war on the horizon with China? Are you impacted by tariffs China is imposing on American goods? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington is Karen Tumulty, political columnist for The Washington Post. Karen, always great to have you with us.
Wonderful to be here, Jane.
Thank you. Also from Washington, Olivier Knox, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News. Olivier, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much, Jane.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Karen, and Olivier.
So we'll start with the Chinese tariffs. President Trump said on Thursday that he will consider hitting China with an additional $100 billion in tariffs. That's on top of the $50 billion he already authorized. The White House, Karen Tumulty, trying to minimize threats of a trade war here. How does this change the equation, Karen?
It just leaves everything extremely uncertain because we do have the president escalating this, and then we get a flood of his economic advisors going, no, this isn't a trade war, and, you know, essentially trying to, trying to give the impression that all they're really doing is laying the predicate for negotiations here. But it's obviously making the markets extremely nervous.
Here's National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow Wednesday on Fox Business Network insisting that the United States and China are not in a trade war.
There's no trade war here. What you've got is the early stages of a process that will include tariffs, comments on the tariffs, then ultimate decisions and negotiations.
And here's China's ambassador to the U.S. telling CNBC this country will continue to fight back against tariffs and trade measures levied by the United States.
We certainly don't want to have any trade war with anybody. But people have to understand who started all this.
So, Olivier Knox, this story just crossing the Associated Press, China says it will, quote, counterattack with great strength, end quote, if Trump acts on new tariff threat. So what's the rationale here, Olivier? A protracted and damaging trade war does not benefit anyone, seems.
So remember how this starts. This starts with the president imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. It's long been true that American experts have said that China has been flooding world markets. It's not necessarily direct trade with the United States. Sometimes it goes through other countries. And then we've had these next two waves. One of the things that's really interesting is the amount of confusion over these announcements, because what the Trump administration is doing is considering tariffs. He still has at least a month, more than a month, to make the actual decision. There's confusion about the amount of the tariffs, whether it's $100 billion in new tariffs or tariffs on $100 billion of Chinese exports. Mm. So there's a lot of confusion about this. If you're a soybean farmer or if you work for Boeing, you probably feel this is a trade war because you are seeing soybean futures be even more volatile than they usually are. You're wondering whether you should put them in the ground or go for an alternate crop. If you're at Boeing, you're very concerned about the prospects that China will scrap some long-term orders and go instead with the European rival Airbus. So the rationale coming out of the White House is to say, even though the president himself said that trade wars are good and easy to win, that this is not a trade war, that in fact what this is doing is launching a negotiating process with China to convince China to take steps, notably on intellectual property theft, which has been an issue in U.S.-China trade relations for decades.
Mm. Jack Beatty, do you see it that way? Is this the start of a negotiation process on other issues?
Well, it could also be kind of Russian roulette. We don't know. You know, Olivier quoted the president saying trade wars are good and they can be won against fierce competition. That may be the single most reckless and ill-considered thing the president has said. He has a view of trade that is sort of pre-Adam Smith. He with the mercantilists of the 17th century, he seems to believe that the country that has the most, that accumulates the most money, in this case, has the most favorable trade balance, is the winner. And to run a trade deficit is to lose. I don't lose when I go to the store and I buy a shirt made in China. I gain. I don't lose when I buy a computer that's hundreds of dollars cheaper because it's put together there. I gain. Millions of consumers gain. Mm-hmm. That is all something he has never seen back from the days when he was attacking Japan in the 80s. He's a little bit like what Talleyrand said of the Bourbon kings. They learned nothing and forgot nothing. Mm.
Karen Tumulty, you look at an economy that's doing quite well right now, right? I mean, the jobs report is out today, shows the U.S. just added 103,000 jobs, which the president, I guess, can claim some credit for. And now this, what do you see?
I see a lot of very frustrated Republicans because the strength of this economy is basically the only thing they have going for them going into this midterm election. And among other things, if in fact there are these high tariffs and that they increase the price of a lot of consumer goods for Americans, that essentially wipes out any benefit that Americans have gotten from this tax cut, which is the Republicans' only legislative accomplishment mm-hmm. for this 2 year and a half that they have been held, you know, every single lever of power in Washington. So Trump is very much trying to speak, I think, to his base in the industrial Midwest, but Republicans who are running across the country are essentially seeing, their entire message to the degree they have any at all for this midterm election being blown to smithereens, potentially.
Let me get Brian in here, a listener from Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Thanks, Jane. Mm-hmm. I'd just like to make a comment from a perspective of a small business owner. We make food packaging equipment, so this is a little obscure, but mm-hmm. about 5% of our sales go to China. Our customers are the customers that are packaging the products that are made out of soy and everything else. They're going to get hammered. Mm-hmm. And then the components that are used to make our products come from China. So even though our products are not yet on the tariff list and it won't affect us much, this is going to have a huge ripple effect across the entire economy that nobody has seemingly thought through. Yeah. And that was just the basis of my comment.
Interesting, Brian. Thank you. I'm so glad you called. Olivia Knox sets a great point. What's the ripple effect of all this?
Well, I mean, that's one of the biggest questions. I mean, you know, one of the ways that the White House drafted the list of products to be targeted, which includes as random things as artificial teeth, epinephrine, and flamethrowers, was that they ran it through an analysis to show that suggested to them that there were alternative production sources, so that the actual disruption would be minimized. Now, the problem is that's a roll of the dice. It's a major roll of the dice. And if you're someone like Brian, you know, I'm thinking Brian doesn't like having additional uncertainty injected into his business model. So there is a question about that. You know, there have been questions about what the tariffs on steel and aluminum would do. Okay, so aluminum gets more expensive over that's because a tariff is a tax. What happens to, you know, beer makers who use aluminum mm-hmm. in cans? Mm-hmm. What happens to all these different prices up and down the production scale? If I really like the way Brian phrased it, because it is so complicated. You have American businesses that need stuff from China in order to make things that go to China. I've been wondering this entire time just what the U.S. ambassador to China, Terry Branstad, the former Iowa governor, is thinking about all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, he represented a state that sends an enormous amount of foodstuffs to China. I wonder what his advice to the president has been. It certainly doesn't seem to have been followed, whatever it was. But I do wonder what he's thinking right now.
Well, we'll keep watching that and this whole story. For now, I want to move on to Syria, because on Tuesday, President Trump said he wanted to pull troops, all American troops, out of Syria.
I want to get out. I want to bring our troops back home. I want to start rebuilding our nation.
Karen Tumulty, president said he wants Arab allies to take over, pay for stabilization, reconstruction, essentially put more skin in the game, as Sarah Sanders said, press secretary Sarah Sanders said this week. Is this a mid-course correction in foreign policy as you see it?
Well, this again is a situation where the president and his advisors seem to be on very different pages. The president in private meetings, it's being reported, is saying he just wants the troops out. And his top foreign policy advisors, his top military advisors, the Joint Chiefs of Staff are trying to convince him that this in fact could just essentially leave a vacuum that could undo the progress that's been made against ISIS and essentially, you know, open up the capabilities for other organizations. So, again, this is something where the president is sort of being a one-man band, and a lot of his closest advisors are quite alarmed by essentially, you know, getting these marching orders without having the sort of deliberative processes that you would go through for everybody to understand exactly what we're talking about here.
Right. So, Jack Beatty, is this a presidential impulse minus a strategy?
I think that's right. It's also a presidential campaign promise.
Right.
You know, in the campaign, that was really his differentiator from Hillary Clinton. It was clear that she had her instincts were much more interventionist than his, and he was saying, "No, come home, America," and that resonated.
We are talking about the week's top stories with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Olivier Knox of Yahoo News, and Jack Beatty. You can join us, listeners. Do you want troops at the border with Mexico? Do you believe the president when he says he didn't know about the payment to Stormy Daniels? Can you keep up with all things Scott Pruitt at the EPA? Much more after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the week in the news, and you can join the conversation. What's on your mind this week? Troops on the border, Facebook, the wild stock market, the mess at the EPA. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Olivier Knox of Yahoo News, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Here's President Trump at a meeting at the White House on Tuesday, saying he wants to send the National Guard to the border with Mexico to confront illegal immigration.
Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military. That's a big step. We really haven't done that before, or certainly not very much before.
And here's former Navy Admiral James Stavridis, now dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University, speaking with Morning Edition today on NPR, explaining why military troops should not be sent to the U.S. border with Mexico.
The choice of active duty military, National Guard, on that border is an opportunity cost in the sense that we can no longer train and prepare for the actual mission of those troops, which is combat. Secondly, these are combat troops. They're trained to apply lethal force. That's not what you want to do on the border. And thirdly, they don't have the linguistic training necessary. They really can't be culturally attuned the way Border Patrol agents are.
Karen Tumulty, there's a point-counterpoint there. What do you see prompting this latest announcement by the president?
Well, one thing that is not prompting it is reality. In fact, you know, immigration flows have been dropping, have been relatively low. What it feels like is that the president is returning to campaign mode. He's sounding very much like, you know, the Donald Trump who came down the escalator and announced his candidacy. I mean, on top of this, we had him in West Virginia yesterday talking about, you know, immigrants as rapists. It's just that the situation on the ground does not really does not really suggest the kind of crisis that you hear in the president's rhetoric. I think what you are hearing on his part, too, is a lot of frustration over the fact that he has been unable to get his signature campaign promise, which is, you know, funding for a wall on the border. And so he is essentially trying to make it sound like there is a crisis going on at, you know, at a time when the numbers at least would suggest there is not. He's also made a lot out of this, you know, caravan of immigrants, of refugees coming through Mexico this week, and suggested that they were on their way to take advantage of the DACA program, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which, of course, they would not even be eligible for. But he is just essentially, you know, trying to take everything that he can and wrap it into one big ball of immigration panic.
Karen, you mentioned the number of illegal immigrants is down. According to the U.S. Border Patrol, their own numbers say that immigrants caught at the border is at its lowest point since 1971. Olivier Knox, is this as simple as the president can't get funding for the border wall, so he wants to use the military to do that job? I mean, translate this for us.
I think Karen's point before that one was the salient one. I mean, if you think back to the president's 2016 campaign, look at three main planks, right? One was anti-immigration. One was, I'll take it to China. And one was this sort of kind of weird non-interventionism that coupled, I'm not going to nation build with, you know, I'm going to beat the heck out of ISIS. And what you've had this week is the president returned to all three over the objections of his advisors. The Syria policy announcement was announced at the very same time that the general who oversees the troops who are in Syria was making the case for why they should stay. On immigration, it's the same thing. The White House was barely done bragging about border crossings being at a 47-year low when the president, literally threw his prepared remarks into the air and gave that sort of fire and brimstone anti-immigration speech. I think that the political considerations, the electoral considerations, you know, there are now multiple news reports that the withdrawal from Syria is being timed so that it happens in October, right before the election. I think it's absolutely inescapable that while I'm sure he believes all of these things, that the timing is closely tied to the midterm elections.
A lot of listeners want to get in here from our website. And Steph says, what exactly is the National Guard going to do? They're going to be ordered to do if they see people crossing the border, capture them, put them in prisons, shoot them, scare them away like scarecrows. It's nearly impossible to envision a situation where this ends well, but it's quite easy to imagine this devolving into a costly and tragic humanitarian crisis with America playing the bad guy. Let's get Dennis in here from Two Rivers, Wisconsin. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. I know Trump has talked about drug dealers and terrorists coming over the border. So my question is, what kind of weapons are these National Guard troops going to have? Are they going to have tanks? Or are they just going to have rifles?
Mm-hmm. Dennis, thanks. Jack Beatty, do we know? Do we know what this consists of?
I just don't know. There's precedent for it. Maybe Karen or Olivier can speak to it. But both in the Bush administration and the Obama administration, troops were sent down there. Were they armed? Do we know? What was that like?
Karen?
I think that it was considered ultimately, you know, not a particularly effective way of doing anything. I mean, if you have troops, they're probably going to be armed, but this administration has not been clear on that. When you've seen it, though, used as almost a stunt, when Rick Perry was running for president and was governor of Texas, he too sent the National Guard down to the border. It just is generally more of a show than it is anything else. Mm. This is not an effective way to control immigration.
Olivia, you mentioned the caravans coming up through Mexico. On Monday, Fox News host Tucker Carlson debated immigration rights advocate Enrique Morones about these so-called caravans of Central American migrants heading toward the U.S. that apparently has captivated President Trump's attention for several days now.
The United States interfering in these countries, the demand for the drugs, invading a sovereign land like Iraq or interfering in the civil wars of Central America, that causes people to flee. The U.S. should be more welcoming.
So our sins, much our more sins are the reason this is. So you hate America is what you're saying.
Olivier Knox, so how do you see this moving forward? National Guard's going to go down there? Is that the basic?
Well, remember that one of the important things about the National Guard is that the federal government has to work this out with the governors of the border states. And so one of the reasons that we don't know yet exactly what the force posture is going to be for the National Guard is that they haven't worked this out with the White House. The National Guard is actually limited in what it can do. There are laws on the books about using the military on American soil. And so that adds a layer of uncertainty about this. These caravans have occurred before, and they've had a largely symbolic purpose, and they've usually disbanded well before they reach the border. There's no doubt that they've captivated the president. And he said, without any evidence whatsoever, that that the result of the caravan was that women were being raped in large numbers. So I think. Unfortunately, all I can tell you is TBD on all of these issues, TBD on what they're going to do with China, TBD with what they're going to do on Syria. And the border is also very much a question mark for me.
All right. We'll keep watching that as well, of course. Moving on to President Trump, who made his first comments this week about the Stormy Daniels matter, telling reporters aboard Air Force One yesterday he did not know about his lawyer Michael Cohen's hush money payment of $130,000 to the porn star Stormy Daniels. Stormy Daniels' attorney, Michael Avenatti, told MSNBC this was good news for their legal case.
We waited patiently, and lo and behold, Christmas has arrived. The president's comments on Air Force One are serious for him, serious for Michael Cohen. How can you have an agreement when one party claims that they don't know anything about the agreement? I mean, these guys are making it up as they go along. They don't know what to say from day in and day out. And our case just got a whole lot better.
Karen Tumulty, did it? Is this a lot of bluster, or is he right? Did the president's comments create a serious predicament for him?
That is really unclear because, our default answer here, there's still a lot about this that we don't know. We don't know if Michael Cohen, the president's attorney, had some sort of agreement with the president that he was essentially going to, you know, have his authority to go out and essentially make problems like Stormy Daniels disappear, sort of a broader agency agreement. It is going to raise a lot of questions about Michael Cohen's actions here at a minimum, and potentially, you know, could put his law license in jeopardy. Mm.
All right. A lot of listeners interested in the Scott Pruitt situation at the EPA. Wednesday on Fox News, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt defended his use of a downtown Washington condo owned by Vicky Hart, the wife of a prominent lobbyist who had been lobbying Pruitt himself over a pipeline deal. Pruitt paid only $50 a night for the privilege.
It was like an Airbnb situation. When I was not there, the landlord, they had access to the entirety of the facility. When I was there, I only had access to a room. There were common areas. They used the facility at the same time that I was there.
So you only paid for the nights you rented, you were there.
That's exactly right.
So, but that's kind of a sweetheart deal because
no,
like
it's not. You're
Jack Beatty, how do you see this? EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt is implementing the president's agenda so effectively, but then we have these ethical lapses that keep mounting.
They do indeed. And I was particularly amused to see that he fell behind on his $50
a night. Yeah.
I mean, he couldn't even, it underlines the degree to which this was a sweetheart deal in every sense. You know, this sort of petty corruption, as others have pointed out, there are versions of it in other cabinet departments, and it's almost defining of this Trump era. And as others have pointed out, it comes from the top. I mean, the president has been indifferent, it seems to me, to the emoluments clause and his hotels and so on. He's never, we don't know what his taxes say, and his son has been over in India making new deals and on and on. So it's almost as if Trump has an instinct for picking people who are with you might call ethical obliquity. They don't quite see things the way a normal person would. They see a $31,000 dining set. That doesn't sound so bad. We need a new dining. There's something wrong in the selection process, and that is the man who selected these people is indifferent to these things, unless they make headlines, in which case he tries to get rid of the people.
Let's go to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nate, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I was actually going to mention the lack of ethics as well, not only on Mr. Pruitt's part, both for doing what he's doing to the EPA and for what he's doing to himself. But also now that some of it has been revealed, the lack of ethics on the part of the Koch brothers and the Heritage Foundation, in that they're coming forward in their groups to defend this guy and try to keep him in his job because they like how easy it is on polluters.
Nate, thank you very much for the call. Olivia Knox, how do you see this situation at the EPA, specifically Scott Pruitt?
I think there are a couple of salient points, one of which you alluded to, which is that that Scott Pruitt's job security lies in the fact that he is carrying out the president's deregulatory agenda quite aggressively. It's sort of the same factor with Jeff Sessions, who's carrying out both the anti-immigration and the remaking of the federal judges. So he's got some job security there. The flip side is that even before this avalanche of Scott Pruitt news, he was already getting crosswise with his boss because he was rather clumsily lobbying to replace Jeff Sessions. White House officials told me this is like 3 weeks ago now. We're saying like, yeah, we know exactly where all the stories saying maybe Scott Pruitt could be the new attorney general are coming from. They're coming from Scott Pruitt. So he was already in a little bit of trouble. Just the avalanche of these, and there's no let up, right? He's he wants to turn on the sirens of his official car because he's late for dinner at a fancy French restaurant, tells the security, the career security detail person, tells him, no, you can't do that. And just a couple weeks later, that person is fired from the security detail.
Right.
There's this nonstop flood of information. He reassigns people who object to his personal spending at EPA. He's in a bad spot, and I put zero stock in the president's comments about Scott Pruitt being safe, because what we've seen in this pattern is the president denying that someone is in any kind of trouble, denying that anyone's going to be replaced. No, I'm not getting rid of H.R. McMaster as national security advisor. This story that I'm replacing Tillerson with Mike Pompeo, the CIA director, is a lie. And then, a few weeks, months later, it turns out to be accurate.
Via tweet. Laura in Des Moines, Iowa, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you, Jane. So just to echo what your guest said, the nepotism and sort of unethical behavior, in my eyes as an environmentalist, actually can be sort of a glass half full situation where, they've done some really awful things. I don't want to make light of that. But really, they are so ineffectual and, kind of stepping on their own toes, and the right arm doesn't know what the left arm is doing. So from an environmental standpoint, I feel like that kind of slows down that momentum that they have of, just sort of the sort of rape and pillage of our natural resources. And then I do want to say about, what sort of ammunition and guns that they may use on the border. You don't have to look very far. You just go to Standing Rock and you see what National Guard and hired contractors did there to peaceful protesters. I was there. There were percussion grenades. There were water cannons. Mm-hmm. There were dogs. So I don't think you need to wonder about that as far as what will happen on the border.
Laura, thanks very much. Karen Tumulty, back to Scott Pruitt for just a couple of minutes here. How do you see this unfolding? It might be difficult to get someone else through the confirmation process at this point.
Well that's true, but something else has happened, which is that at the moment when the White House is telling Scott Pruitt to sort of just keep a low profile here, he has also been going to conservative media, Fox and other outlets, to sort of defend himself, to claim he's being made a martyr, that this is, all of these allegations are nothing. It's just essentially the deep state rising up to try and undo him because of his policy positions. The White House is also letting it be known that they are annoyed at that, that, he is essentially, disobeying what they want him to be doing in this. And I think that is another thing that ultimately is going to potentially get him on the wrong side of the president. And I think that, you know, at that point, it may be, you know, you create enough embarrassing headlines for Donald Trump and you are out of there.
We are discussing the week in the news with a terrific panel today. Karen Tumulty, political columnist for The Washington Post, Olivier Knox, chief Washington correspondent for Yahoo News, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join us, listeners. What would you pay to remove targeted ads from Facebook? Would you at all? Is the revelation that President Trump is not a criminal target in the Mueller probe good news for him? We'll talk about that after the break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
NPR's Code Switch tackles race and identity in America with humanity and humor. You'll laugh, you'll learn, you'll get uncomfortable. It's worth it. Find Code Switch on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. In other news this week, the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. Reverend Jesse Jackson spoke at the site of his assassination in Memphis.
We never stopped fighting. We never gave up. We never gave up. We never gave out. From this balcony in Memphis, the balcony in the White House is 40 years in the wilderness.
March Madness wrapped up this week with Villanova taking the men's college basketball national championship. Notre Dame secured the women's championship in a buzzer beater.
For the win! Good! Arete Ogunbowale wins the national championship for Notre Dame!
And John Legend starred in NBC's live telecast of Jesus Christ Superstar on Easter Sunday. Here he sings Gethsemane, I Only Want to Say.
I'd want to know, I'd want to know, my God. I'd want to know, I'd want to know, my God. I'd want to see, I'd want to see, my God.
You can join the conversation, listeners. Is an apology from Facebook too little, too late? Do you stand with teachers in Oklahoma and Kentucky? What will it take to pay teachers a fair wage? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Olivier Knox of Yahoo News, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. News this morning that the United States has imposed sweeping new sanctions on senior Russian politicians, companies, and business leaders, citing a list of complaints, including Moscow's attempt to undermine Western democracies. Karen Tumulty, these new sanctions appear to be the most aggressive actions to date against Russia. What do you see here?
Well, our theme of the day is the president's administration doing one thing and the president himself doing another. We have, in fact, seen a lot of tough measures against Russia coming out of the administration as policy.
So, Olivia Knox, do you think this will provoke a strong response from Moscow?
Well, the last round of sanctions got sort of derision, public derision from Moscow. But I think it's fair to cast this in the general climate regarding Moscow's relationship with the West, which is really at a low point now in the aftermath of that nerve agent attack in the UK. I'm not going to predict what Russia is going to do in response. They of course, threatened to expel just as many U.S. diplomats as the U.S. was expelling from U.S. soil. So there could be some kind of reciprocity. Historically, they've put some major critics of Russia on a no travel to Russia list, which typically makes those critics laugh because they had no plans to go anyway. But it's really important to notice this administration has really tightened the vise on Russia quite a bit, including by directly attributing really nasty cyber warfare directly to Russia. And not that long ago, tying the 2016 election meddling to military intelligence, which is basically the same thing as putting it on Putin's doorstep. Mm. Karen's right, though, that there are two Russia policies. One of them is the Trump administration, and one of them is the president himself, who cannot bring himself to say a bad word about Vladimir Putin and who's only sort of given lukewarm support to the intelligence community's findings that Moscow interfered in 2016. Mm. So one of the big questions is, you know, is the president's rhetoric going to change? He likes to say that no one's been tougher on Russia than he has. If you look at the Trump administration, I suppose you can build that argument. saying, you know, lethal defensive weapons shipped to Ukraine, and these waves of sanctions and these direct accusations of cyber wrongdoing. I think those are all pretty important. But it's just not clear to me that the president's going to change his own personal view, which is he wants a better relationship with Vladimir Putin.
Which brings us to Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Jack Beatty, what happened in the Mueller investigation this week?
Well, one thing that happened is we learned that Mr. Mueller has told the White House counsel that the president is a subject of his investigation, not a target. And there was at least an interval there where you heard a sigh of relief on Fox News, or at least I thought I heard it. But then it sunk in that Mr. Manafort, Paul Manafort, was a subject of the investigation for months before he became a target and now faces jail time that would essentially put him in jail for life if he were to get the maximum. So there's not much comfort there on the issue of being a subject. And this raises the whole issue of what's going to happen with Mueller's report. It from what I've been reading, I may be wrong, but I get the sense this is moving much faster than I had imagined it was going to, and that interviewing the president may be the last or one of the last acts of it, and that Mueller then intends giving his report to Congress. If it's a very tough report, it's bound to be tough. The question is degree. That then sets up the fall election on a momentous sort of axis. Impeach the president or not. And in a peculiar way, I think that could actually help the Republicans electorally. I can imagine that would really panic the GOP base, thinking they're going to throw our president out. We just elected him. And by God, we're going to get to the polls.
Here's one listener from Facebook who wonders about that, Jack, who wonders about that report. He says, I'm a registered Democrat, and yet I am more and more developing the perspective that the Mueller probe is much to do about nothing. Let's get Todd in here on this point from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Todd, how do you see it?
Hi, Jane. I think the Mueller probe is something that we have to go through because, you know, our democratic elections were obviously interfered with by Russia. But my thought with the president is, I mean, all of the, I have to say this, idiotic things that have happened in the last year and his deniability on so much of it, to me, it's been a smokescreen to get away from the Mueller probe. But in my opinion, either he looks like he's this useful idiot that really doesn't have any control over anything that's going on in his life, or he's a guilty party to it. And there's only two
options. Todd, I hear you. Thank you very much for the call from Oklahoma. Let's get Bob in here from Brevard, North Carolina. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I think that what's going to happen is that the president's lack of impulse control is going to be his undoing, particularly if he ever gets in front of Mueller. I mean, we saw last night with him going back on Air Force One, he just couldn't help himself and had to make those comments about Stormy Daniels, and now he's probably going to get himself deposed.
Bob, thank you. Karen Tumulty, it's an excellent point that Bob raises. Will the president's sort of lack of impulse control, to put it bluntly, will it undo him in the Mueller probe?
Well, first of all, it is important to remember that the president has basically a very thin legal team at this moment, and they do not have a lot of experience in kind of white-collar criminal defense. But what we do know is that the advice he's getting from his lawyers is that they do not want him to go and submit to this interview. The president keeps saying that, yes, he wants to do it. He somehow is convinced that he can, I guess, kind of talk his way through this, which will be very interesting. I mean, I have talked to lawyers here in Washington who have a lot of experience in this field who say it is not outside the realm of possibility, and were Donald Trump their client, that they might advise him to do something no president has ever done before, which is go in there and plead the fifth.
Olivia Knox, anything you want to add to this before we move on?
I'm watching this with as much interest as anybody else. I think, you know, it's starting to feel like every president I cover ends up taking questions in an uncomfortable setting. There was George W. Bush, of course, being questioned by the 9/11 Commission, although that was an interview, wasn't under oath. And of course, there was Bill Clinton in front of Ken Starr's grand jury. I am sort of struck by the impatience with the Mueller investigation, in the sense that federal investigations take a long time. And the arguably the most important sentence in 2017 in American politics was the sentence in Mueller's appointment that said that he was empowered to investigate any other issues that arise as part of his look into the Russia story, which is, of course, what has led his investigation to go in a lot of other different directions, at least according to the news reporting. But the impatience has really been striking, and obviously it serves the White House's purposes pretty well.
Let's move on to Facebook now. The number of Facebook users whose data was improperly shared with a political consulting firm connected to President Trump during the election of 2016 has now reached 87 million people. That's far higher than the 50 million that was widely cited earlier. Here's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg telling reporters in a call on Wednesday that he alone is at fault for the Cambridge Analytica scandal.
It's clear now that we didn't do enough. We didn't focus enough on preventing abuse and thinking through how people could use these tools to do harm as well. And that goes for fake news, foreign interference in elections, hate speech, in addition to developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of what our responsibility is, and that was a huge mistake. It was my mistake.
And here's Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg explaining to NBC Today Show host Savannah Guthrie in an interview that aired today what it would look like for Facebook users to opt out of targeted advertising.
Could you have an opt-out button? Please don't use my profile data for advertising.
We have different forms of opt-out. We don't have an opt-out at the highest level. That would be a paid product.
A paid product, Jack Beattie, you'd have to pay to completely opt out of the data that's being used on Facebook. Wow.
Yeah, you know, this is a high-tech robber baron. The robber barons, the cliche comes from, you know, people who put chains across the Rhine River and held up anybody trying to get through and said, you got to pay a tariff to get down the river. Well, here, to get on the social network with the other billion people, we have to give up our privacy. It's not so bad. And, you know, this guy, Zuckerberg, I'm just looking at Margaret Sullivan's piece about him in the Washington Post. She points out that at age 19, when he was setting up this social network as an undergraduate at Harvard as a way to meet girls, I think that was the idea, he bragged to a friend about how he got those kids to give him photos and addresses and so on. He wrote in a message, "They trust me, dumb blank blank." Boy, I don't see that it's changed at all for him. We trust him, and we are dumb blank blank for doing it.
Let's get Linda in here from Detroit, Michigan. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Jane. I just want to say that I think that they should be paying us to provide them information. You know, they want our information. They should pay us to be on Facebook if they want us.
Not the other way around. All right, Linda, thank you so much. From one tech company to another, this past week, the president has turned what were sporadic and often private criticisms of Amazon into a sustained volley of tweets against the company, which caused some stock market fluctuations, to say the least. Karen Tumulty, it appears the president's ire is fueled not so much toward Amazon as to Jeff Bezos, who owns your paper, The Washington Post, I guess, whose reporting he doesn't like. What do you see in all that?
Well, first of all, it is important to make clear the distinction here. The Washington Post is not part of Amazon. We have Jeff Bezos owns the newspaper, but we are not part of Amazon. There are, you know, any number of explanations for what's going on here. You know, these are two very wealthy men who are, you know, represent two very different cultures. But the president is saying a lot of things about Amazon, of which the Washington Post is not a part, that are just not true, among other things, that somehow, you know, the Postal Service is heavily subsidizing Amazon. The fact is that package delivery has been almost the only bright spot for the United States Postal Service. Mm-hmm. He has also accused my newspaper, where I must say I have never heard in this newsroom even a hint of Jeff Bezos guiding or interfering with news coverage, but he has somehow decided that our newspaper is a lobbyist for Amazon, again, to which we have no connection other than the fact that we are owned by Jeff Bezos. So he just seems to be throwing a lot of things at Jeff Bezos and fueling some sort of resentment that is probably very, very complicated.
I want to wrap up this hour by playing this clip, a scene in West Virginia yesterday. President Trump, shortly into a prepared speech on tax reform, he literally threw up the script, threw it out, tossing his papers over his shoulders and said this.
You know, this was going to be my remarks. It would have taken about 2 minutes, but that would have been a little boring. A little boring. No, I'm reading off the first paragraph. I said, this is boring. Come on, we have to tell it like it is.
Olivier Knox, that scene made sense in the context of some reporting that I have seen this week about the president feeling much more confident in the job, finally settling in, right? Sort of trusting his gut instincts and his gut reaction to issues. He's finally sort of freed himself from advisors who've been confining him, and he's moving forward on policies that got him elected. I mean, how do you see this president right now moving forward?
Well, I think that portrayal that you just gave is not wrong. I do think that when he threw up his remarks, aides and advisors throughout the executive branch reached for the Tums. So did Republicans who are running for office who really need him to highlight the tax cut bill, as Karen pointed out earlier in this conversation. And instead of talking about the signature Republican achievement, I guess apart from the confirmation of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, the president went on an extended and factually challenged rant about immigration. Republicans can't untether themselves from this president. Last year in early March, a senior Republican told me, look, we need the president at 10% or at 51%. He's about at 38. I mean, it depends on which polls you're looking at. Republicans can't push him off. They don't want to hug him too closely. They're in a bind. So I think that's how I see this president right now, as giving his fellow GOPers a bit of a headache.
Well, we got a lot in here this hour. Thanks to a great panel for making sense of it all. Olivier Knox, Chief Washington Correspondent for Yahoo News. Great to have you, Olivier. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Karen Tumulty, Political Columnist for The Washington Post. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
And On Point News Analyst Jack Beattie. Have a good weekend, Jack. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jane.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson. Have a good weekend. This is On Point.